KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, the state legislature is set to vote tomorrow on a suite of funding and other bills designed to address the state's acute housing shortage. Among the measures is Senate Bill 35, which would force California cities that are not building adequate affordable housing to streamline their approval processes. Supporters say it's time to get rid of cumbersome local rules that tie up projects, but critics say the bill would prevent residents of low-income communities from having a say in development planned in their backyards. We'll take up the debate. It's coming up after the news. Welcome to this morning's Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. The California State Legislature is set to vote on a package of affordable housing bills as early as tomorrow. Among the bills is Senate Bill 35, or the Housing Accountability and Affordability Act, which would streamline the approval process for development projects in cities that are not meeting regional affordable housing goals. Supporters of SB 35 say the measure is needed to tackle the state's critical housing shortage. But opponents say the bill wrests control of housing policy from local governments and could actually make housing more expensive in low-income Bay Area neighborhoods. We'll take up the debate in this hour, and we'll get an update on the status of some other housing bills before state lawmakers. And joining us from Sacramento is Guy Maserati. Guy Maserati is a reporter with KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. And good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Michael.
Good to have you, and I guess we can really get a good overview from you on this, but we're going to concentrate on 35, which is, as I said, to an attempt to streamline the process for development projects, especially in those cities that don't meet affordable housing goals. But this is pretty much billed as a suite of bills. That is 35, 2, and 3. Can you pretty much give us some nuances as to why these three are being put together?
That's right. So I think, as you said, a vote could come as early as tomorrow on the outlines of this deal that includes those different bills. We've been seeing these bills come together for months, and they really bring together both the new funding for affordable housing that's in Senate Bill 2, Senate Bill 3, as well as these really big changes proposed to local development laws through Senate Bill 35. So I think the biggest holdup politically right now is Senate Bill 2, that proposal to add a fee on certain real estate transactions to add more money for affordable housing. That's going to be a tough sell to some moderate Democrats because it does need a two-thirds vote. Senate Bill 35, on the other hand, is just a majority vote.
But you're suggesting or intimating maybe the 35 is likely to get through?
In the Senate, it definitely had a bipartisan support. It just needs a majority. In the Senate, it was able to get a number of Republican votes. It kind of breaks down not along traditional political lines because it really deals with locals and their housing rules. I think lawmakers much more followed their districts on this vote. You saw Democrats, vote against it in coastal areas in Marin and Ventura County. And then you saw a lot of Republicans who may want to see more development in their districts join with the author, Senator Wiener, to support this bill.
Well, there are about 100 bills in line having to do with housing. But since you mentioned Senator Wiener, who sponsored this bill, he said, that he's not sure how many new homes the measure would produce. And I think, as indicated, wouldn't make much of a dent.
Well, it is difficult, I think, long range to see, how the bill would specifically affect the number of homes developed. But I think it gets at the fact that California really hasn't built the amount of homes that it used to. In decades past, California would approve hundreds of thousands of homes each year, and that kind of stopped after the Great Recession. There hasn't been a single year since the Great Recession that we've seen, 100,000 new home permits. So part of that is due to national trends in the construction industry. But I think locals see a lot of, or state legislators see a lot of red tape at the local level that they say is really holding up developments in certain areas.
Understood. And I don't want to sound too pessimistic about this, but if you look at, for example, reports from the State Department of Housing and Community Development, this wouldn't keep up with population growth. I mean, you'd need about 180,000 times, according to them, to accommodate.
I think you're right. And all the lawmakers, I think, in this process have admitted that the entire package wouldn't completely solve the housing crisis. I mean, for the state to actually subsidize its way towards more affordable housing, it would need to be spending upwards of $30 billion a year. the package that's being proposed is far short of that. This is a $3 billion or $4 billion housing bond. So it's being sold by its proponents as kind of the first step towards addressing the state's housing crisis. But in no way would this package alone solve the affordability issues that we're seeing around the state.
Guy Maserati with us from Sacramento is a reporter for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Could you also say something about what Scott Wiener has included in this bill? I mean, it includes higher wages for construction workers. That's some of the red tape you alluded to before, but accepting union-level hiring and union standards.
That's right. I think to build a consensus around this bill, there have been a lot of amendments made along the way, including, as you mentioned, this prevailing wage requirement that would require certain wages in these developments. And that has gotten the building industry on board. Just earlier this week, there was a large rally held with construction workers supporting this bill.
Yeah, but forgive me, Guy, it's also got a lot of opposition from business, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that these kind of wage requirements, the governor himself has argued in the past, you're going to save much money if in the end a lot of this money has to go towards higher wages for building. So I think he's argued that if you don't take that piece out of it, you're not really streamlining. But in the end, he has supported Senate Bill 35. And then there's also been questions around the bill around, low income issues. Concern is that if you encourage all developments in a certain area, then market rate developers are going to rush in to get their projects built and edge out some low income developments. I think Senator Wiener has tried to work around that with first the fact that the bill is only going to apply to specific income levels that cities haven't addressed. So, for example, San Francisco has definitely met its need in terms of market rate development. Senate Bill 35 wouldn't really apply to market rate development in the city. And then also some amendments to block development from qualifying if it's going to demolish rent controlled or demolish existing low income housing.
Now, we should mention that Governor Brown's plan originally was to have every city and county included, but with Scott Wiener's plan, we've got only those who are behind on state goals in their communities. So the deadline on this for passage, September 15th, is that right, Guy?
That's right. That's when the legislature leaves for the first year of this 2-year session. So, this legislation, if it doesn't get done in September, could always come back next year. But the goal is definitely to get it done by September 15th and to put the bond measure on the ballot in 2018.
Guy, thank you for joining us. Good to hear from you. Guy Maserati, again, is reporter with KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. And thanks for leading us off here in this opening hour of Forum.
Thanks so much.
And let me tell you who is joining us. We're going to get into debate about this funding for affordable housing, which is going to be headed for a vote in the legislature. Laura Foote Clark is here in studio with us. She's executive director of YIMBY Action. It's an affordable housing advocacy group. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Fernando Marti, who joins us by phone. He's co-director of the Council of Community Housing Organizations. They're a coalition of 25 San Francisco nonprofit affordable housing developers, housing service providers, and tenant advocates, and they are opposed to the bill. They want lots of amendments. Fernando Marti, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Laura Foote Clark, let me begin with you. This is necessary to force these cities who are not, from your perspective, right? Because they're doing retail and office stuff and they're not doing the job.
Definitely. Every municipality has an incentive to just add more jobs and to continue to chronically underbuild housing. And it's why we have this crazy housing shortage everywhere in California. And I think in the Bay Area, it's the worst.
It is indeed the worst in the Bay Area. And also, what do you say, though, about the argument, and we'll hear this probably from Fernando Marti, that despite the crisis, what this bill does is takes away control of housing policy from local governments and, in fact, could increase the cost of housing for low-income areas, neighborhoods?
I think that's just patently false. These are regional housing goals. Local control should mean that you get to decide how you get to meet your goals, but not whether or not you meet them. All of these municipalities have just been ignoring their regional obligations and just not building the housing. They've been slow-walking projects. They've been deliberately underbuilding housing because there's not good tax incentives for them. Each municipality wants those hotel taxes, wants to not have to deal with, like, where the kid's going to go to school and all of that stuff. And so they just don't build the housing. And they think someone else will do it. And that drives up the cost for everyone.
So, Fernando Marti, why is this actually going to help people in low-income communities? I mean, why is this against helping people in low-income communities?
So, first of all, I think I completely agree with what Laura is saying about the incentives that cities have for building or not building housing. I think the question that we have before us is that we're in a housing affordability crisis. We need more affordable housing. And what SB 35 purports to do, although even Senator Wiener says it might not actually make that much difference, is it's going to help to get cities to create more unaffordable housing. We need affordable housing, and we need it now. And the deal that is being promoted as a package right now in Sacramento is let's cut some red tape, let's deregulate the unaffordable housing, and in return, we will promote a bond measure that still has to go before the voters next year to provide some funding for some affordable housing. And in the meantime, there are both neighborhoods, like in San Francisco, the Mission District, the Tenderloin, where neighborhoods have been able to negotiate with developers to come in and build a lot more affordable housing within mixed-income communities. The bill, as it is, treats, let's say, Palo Alto, which is, I think, a poster child for a municipality that has stopped all kinds of development, from East Palo Alto, which is a low-income community right next to that Facebook campus that is going to be facing tremendous gentrification pressures and should have the ability to shape what kind of development happens and, if possible, to create more affordable housing out of market rate housing.
So you and those who are opposed to the bill... I'm sorry, say again, please.
And SB 35 takes away that power.
Yeah. Now, let me actually get to the point I was going to make here, because I think it's crucial. You're saying this is a recipe for more aggressive gentrification, aren't you?
Absolutely. And part of it is, if SB 35, and this is what we had proposed to the bill authors as a series of amendments, the principal one is, we have very strong data that UC Berkeley has been looking at mapping those areas that are low income, people of color neighborhoods that are facing tremendous displacement and gentrification pressures. Those areas in particular should not be affected by SB 35. SB 35, to its credit, came up with a new metric, much better than I think what the governor had proposed last year. But for example, it leaves Lafayette off the hook. A city that is right on transit, right next to BART line, it won't have to comply with SB 35 because of the way it's written. San Francisco's was mentioned won't have to comply with SB 35 unless there's a recession. So there's the metric has to do with how much is built, and when a recession hits, we build a lot less. So it treats the west side of San Francisco the same as the Tenderloin.
So you need better metrics. That's part of your amendment. Proposals, and I'm going to get a response from Laura Foote Clark on this. I mean, Laura, there are a lot of cities that are off the hook on this, upper class areas, particularly Lafayette, Danville, Dublin, Corte Madera, Los Altos, and this seems in many people's minds to be unfair.
I completely agree with that, which is why when we keep doing our regional housing needs, which is, this is pretty much based on, the regional housing needs allocation will be something where we can further that debate. But if we don't have any ability to force municipalities that aren't building housing to do it, then those numbers are a waste of space. I mean, this is going to force municipalities like Marin to speed up housing production. And in San Francisco, it's going to speed up affordable, the very stuff that Fernando is a big supporter of, and I am too. This is going to only apply to the subsidized affordable housing in San Francisco, and it's going to speed up those projects so that places like Forest Hills are not going to be able to keep out the subsidized affordable housing. I think that's a major step forward. Nope. I think it's really interesting also that in the same breath that people say it doesn't go far enough and doesn't do enough, they also will say it doesn't do anything. And it's not going to be both.
But they also say it gets more acceleration for hot growth areas and slows them down in slow growth areas.
I don't think that that's accurate. I mean, slow growth areas are places that are chronically not meeting their regional housing goals. And maybe in slow growth areas, we need to up those goals and we need to say you need to be doing even more. But we do need to be forcing municipalities that are not meeting their regional goals to be doing something. And if we don't have any stick in order to force those municipalities to do it, they're just going to continue to ignore it.
As I read the bill, though, Fernando Marti, it says you can't do any building in prime farmland. It has to be close to public transportation. It has to be infill. In other words, they're going to have to be inside of urban boundaries, really, aren't they?
That's right. And I think one of the things that Guy Maserati mentioned at the beginning is, you know, the tremendous loss in construction of housing in California. That's both the unaffordable market rate housing and the affordable housing due to the loss of redevelopment that this governor promoted.
So, excuse me, a bottom line here, though, with this bill is you're going to increase the stock, aren't you?
Well,
yeah, what is unaffordable housing?
What he said is we haven't built housing after the recession. So there's a narrative here. You know, this is about red tape. This is about regulations. This is about NIMBYs. Did NIMBYs suddenly become empowered after 2008? Did regulations and red tape suddenly mushroom out of control after 2008? Or is there something else going on? One of the things that I think is very important is that you used two different words, production and approvals. So SB 35 is how much do we approve? How much do developers who go out and get their entitlements are able to approve? But are they actually going to build that housing? And one of the amendments that we wanted to get is to ensure that within 2 years after getting your entitlement, your approval, you as a developer would actually, you know, break ground and build that housing. Well, that's not what developers want. They want to be able to get their approvals and sell, find new investors, and there's a big Ponzi game going on of selling approvals. What we need is production, and production virtually disappeared after 2008. We're building a third today of what we were building before 2008. Is that about red tape?
Well, yeah, we're in a crisis state, no question about it. But you have to define what affordable housing is. I think Laura raises the central question here in many people's minds. How do you really get at what is or isn't affordable housing?
If you're spending more than a third of your income in rent, that is defined as unaffordable. And so a market rate proposal like SB 35 is really about promoting more unaffordable housing. Now, do we have a lack of supply of unaffordable housing? Sure. And what is at the root of it is a complete change in investment. And Guy mentioned this. You know, he said, well, if we were to subsidize this, it might be to the tune of $30 billion. That sounds huge. How much are we going to be spending on high-speed rail from Los Angeles to San Francisco? You know, we have priorities that we need. And what this bill, I think, is trying to do through a deregulation approach is somehow get investors to decide to build when since 2008 they have stopped building, except in a few places. And those few places are San Francisco, Los Angeles, a few high-growth cities. And in some ways, it's a good thing, right? When you look at those numbers of what happened after 2008, California as a whole and the Bay Area, very different from Houston, has stopped building single-family homes to a large extent.
All right, I think we're getting some disagreement from Laura Foote Clark here, and let's have her.
Well, I just think, I mean, are you proposing that everyone live in subsidized affordable housing? I mean, that is a thing that societies have tried to do before. And I'm not necessarily opposed to it so long as we actually build it. But all of the affordable housing funding in the world, it doesn't do you any good if nobody lets you build it.
Well, let me go back to what he raised before. And that is, I know neither one of you want to necessarily see this as a debate framed on NIMBY, but NIMBY comes in here.
I think NIMBY is critical. I mean, NIMBYs are the people who are blocking the housing. I think it's completely absurd to say that nobody's blocking housing, that the developers – I mean, what would be – I'm sorry. What would be the point of paying a lot of money for a fully entitled project if there wasn't any value in a fully entitled project because it is difficult to get your project entitled? I just don't think this makes any sense. Obviously, there are lots of people who oppose housing. I go to hearings every day and listen to people fight against housing. I mean, all up and down the Bay Area, Brisbane, they're fighting it tooth and nail.
So let me ask you directly. I mean, the high cost of housing is driving low-income people out of the state in big numbers, and it's also driving young people to despair and to you know, look elsewhere and so forth. Can you really quantify how this is going to help ameliorate those problems?
I think this is going to force municipalities to have to create systems where they speed up affordable and market rate housing.
And get rid of environmental oversight and those kinds of things, or at least diminish them?
I think that we have to think about what is environmental oversight. If we are using our quote-unquote environmental laws to fight infill housing, and instead our environmental laws are causing us to embrace sprawl and embrace displacement, then these environmental laws are not doing what they should be doing, and they need to be examined carefully. I mean, we could go into CEQA if we want, but there's a lot of debate about what our environmental laws that were passed in the 70s are actually causing us to do as policy today.
So Fernando, no, I want you. I know you want to respond, but I want to do this while I have a moment here and give out the phone number, because I know there are many people who are going to want to weigh in here and ask both of you questions or comments, or at least express their own concerns and opinions. And you can do that, by the way, by calling in now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Again, join us by phone at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website and post any questions or comments there. The website is kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, and you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Laura Foote Clark with us in studio, Executive Director of YIMBY Action, an affordable housing advocacy group, and Fernando Marti with us by phone, Co-Director of the Council of Community Housing Organizations. Go ahead, Fernando.
The question that Laura just raised about, you know, environmental questions and regulations, I think, is a very important question. And, you know, I think digging into that is very important. But what SB 35, the framing for SB 35, is deregulation. It's let's get rid of regulations. And, you know, there's a model for that in this country, and that's Houston. Right?
I think that's a completely unfair characterization.
Zoning that doesn't have that approvals process is not part of that city. So when we talk about particular issues, which I think we can all agree on, you know, there are, CEQA was created in the 1970s. Let's dig into that. Let's see what parts of environmental review need updating. The question here, however, is how do we get more affordable housing that regular people can afford, right? And the gist of SB 35 is that the way you get that is by relaxing regulations on unaffordable housing. And that will somehow create more units on the ground. Even Senator Wiener admits that that might never happen because this is only about approvals. So one of the things that Laura just mentioned was Brisbane. And I think, again, I'd like to find those places where we have common ground, because we're actually more or less on the same page with YIMBY Action around a city like Brisbane that has a huge swath of land that could be developed for housing, deciding that what they want to do, for all the reasons that Laura mentioned, is just big box development, right? And I think we can agree that big box development and office development is going to create jobs, and that those jobs are households that need to be housed somewhere, and that these cities can't continue to offload them somewhere else. In Brisbane, it's not a question of approvals. SB 35 would change nothing about Brisbane Baylands.
Okay,
it's a question
we're getting
of
a little off topic.
Right?
Fernando, we're getting off the topic indeed, and I've got like seconds left with you. I know you have to leave us at 9:30, and we're going to bring Tim Redmond on to take your position, which is opposed to 35. But what would be the top amendment? You've been proposing all kinds of amendments. What would be the top amendment that would make 35 more acceptable to you?
Let me put this in context. There's a package that Guy talked about earlier, right? The package is right now a deal of funding for deregulating market rate housing. To us, a package would be something comprehensive that looks at tenants' rights. So it would look at something like AB 291. It would look at, for example, allowing us to create inclusionary housing.
So we're going to have to leave it there because I'm out of time. I thank you for being with us. Fernando Marti, again, is co-director of the Council of Community Housing Organizations. Tim Redmond will step in for him when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are talking about mainly Proposition 35, which would fund affordable housing, headed for a vote in the state legislature. In fact, tomorrow, Guy Maserati, KQED's California Politics and Government Desk reporter, joined us earlier on and gave us really an overview of this. And there's been a rather strong debate between Laura Foote Clark and Fernando Marti. Fernando Marti is going to be, as I said, replaced by Tim Redmond, who is editor of 48hills.org, an online daily newspaper. Tim, we have you with us?
I'm here.
Okay, good. Glad to have you. But I'm going to go back.
Always happy to be on Forum, Michael.
Well, always happy to have you. And Laura may not be that happy with some of the things that were said before we went to the break, so I'm going to give her a chance to respond. Before we go to callers, there are many people who want to weigh in here. Laura?
I just think one thing to understand is this is not deregulation. This is forcing municipalities to follow their own rules. All of the rules have to be written down, and this is only zoning-compliant projects will be sped up through the process. So if a municipality has a rule about setbacks or about backyards or whatever they want to make rules about, they will still be following all of those rules. And in addition, SB 35 puts in other great things, like I'm very pro-union labor. This is going to increase wages for people. It's going to be encouraging a lot of the things that we want a lot of these projects to have.
Let me get a response to you from this, though. Carol, one of our listeners, writes, not only is SB 35 a gift to developers, but we don't even have the protections we need to keep what little affordable housing we have honestly affordable to minimum wage workers. We should only build housing one can honestly afford on the minimum wage.
I think that's a great ambition, but most of the people who are making minimum wage don't get into the 100% affordable, subsidized affordable housing. Most of those people live in market rate housing. And when market rate housing is too expensive, we have a housing shortage. I think you have to fundamentally ask yourself, are we experiencing a housing shortage? I think we need to build more subsidized affordable housing and more market rate housing in order to bring down the cost of living. It's a very simple equation of we have chronically underbuilt housing for decades, and we are experiencing a shortage. And in shortages, prices skyrocket. And if we want low and middle income people to be able to move to San Francisco and the other cities and thrive here and find opportunities, there are great jobs here. And we're just locking them out by not building housing.
Well, we have over 500,000, I believe, or actually, I'm sorry, we have about 1.7 million low-income California renters who are spending over half their income on housing, and that alone speaks volumes.
Yeah, and most of them are living in market-rate housing. They're not living in subsidized affordable, which we should be doing more to build more of.
And I should be doing more to bring our callers into this. But first, let me go to you, Tim Redmond, and just get your sense of why in opposition to this. If you have more housing stock and more subsidized housing, can't that be a good thing?
Well, my problem, Michael, is that I don't really think that the free market, the housing market as it exists today in California, is going to create housing that minimum wage workers can live in. Minimum wage workers who are living in market rate housing, certainly in San Francisco, many of them are living in existing rent-controlled housing stock. The new housing that the market is going to provide is not going to be affordable to minimum wage workers or to pretty much anyone else who isn't very, very wealthy, because the market doesn't provide moderate income housing. And I don't believe that building more market rate housing is going to bring prices down. It doesn't work that way. The way the housing market works in California right now is it is driven not by what cities want, not by what a small-time developer wants to build next door. It's driven by capital. It's driven by who's going to invest the money in that kind of housing. And the reality is that speculative investment capital wants high-end condos because that's what gives you the highest rate of return. And if we just say, let's build a lot more million-dollar condos, I really don't think that that's going to solve the housing crisis in California. So I really think that this whole idea that the housing, that the free market, the invisible hand of Adam Smith is going to solve our problems hasn't proven to be true in the past, isn't true now, and really kind of ignores the reality of how housing markets actually work in the state. You know, I agree with Fernando that we need to build a tremendous amount of new affordable housing. I agree that Laura, I understand that Laura thinks we should build affordable housing too, but I don't think that the connection that the market itself will eventually provide affordable housing works in California. I think we are, as a state, are simply going to have to accept the fact that we need to spend more public money, a huge amount more public money, the kind of money we're talking about spending on high-speed rail, the kind of money Jerry Brown is talking about spending on two tunnels to suck water from Northern California to Southern California, that level of public infrastructure investment in affordable housing. And I think that's the only thing that's going to solve the crisis.
And you're saying this is really just helping the real estate industry, aren't you?
Well, it will help the real estate industry. It will help the investment industry. It'll help the people who invest money in housing make a higher return on it. But if I thought that building a million more units of high-end market rate housing in California was going to solve the crisis, I'd be all for it. I'm not against building more housing. I'm not a NIMBY. I'm not somebody who doesn't want to see more housing built in San Francisco or California. I have looked at this for many, many years, and I just don't see this being an effective solution. I don't think it's going to make things any better. And it may make them worse, because in some areas, East Palo Alto, for example, building market rate housing drives up land values and it makes it harder to have affordable housing. You drop a couple of million-dollar condo projects in East Palo Alto, and suddenly housing costs go up for everyone, and rent-controlled housing becomes more difficult to find. So I think there are drawbacks to this. But basically, I think we've got to get beyond market-based solutions because I don't think they're going to work.
Okay, let me bring in our callers, and we begin with David. David, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, before the break, Fernando made a point about a secondary market of permits that prevents construction. I just wanted to point out that a secondary market like that can only exist if permits are hard to get. If you make permits easier to get, then a developer just goes and gets their own. There's no reason to buy from somebody else.
Sorry, go ahead. Laura's nodding her head. Go ahead.
Yeah, the second point I want to make is, I guess, I hear a lot of, pro and con affordable versus unaffordable housing, and I don't see a reason for that split. I mean, if you build more housing, that'll send prices down, and maybe it's not for minimum wage people, but I don't know why you need to oppose one to support the other. I feel like we need to do both.
Okay, I'll let that stand as an editorial comment, which, as I said, Laura agrees with. Let me get another caller on quickly. Paulette, join us. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Fascinating and rather disturbing conversation this morning. I have lots of questions, but I'm going to limit it to a larger question. I would really be interested in hearing more about information for the South Bay. Whenever my ears perk up to this conversation, it's usually kind of talked about San Francisco, North Bay. And as you know, there's lots and lots of jobs and lots of growth in the South Bay, and it's getting, very difficult to afford to live here for people.
Well, Laura or Tim, can you give us a brief sketch of what the situation is in the South Bay? Go ahead, Laura.
Yeah. Clark. The South Bay is going to see a lot of they're going to have to actually build housing because they've been kind of the worst actors.
One could say they need it more than any other segment.
They need it more than anyone else. I mean, Apple is building a giant jobs complex down there. Every large industrial park that they have down there where they're adding more and more office and not building housing, they are probably going to see the most amount of housing mandated that they build.
Your thoughts, Tim Redmond, on the South
Bay? Well, I'm interested to know whether Laura thinks, because I know that Senator Wiener does not. I have suggested this, but what about simply saying to Palo Alto and to Mountain View and all these other cities, you can't add new jobs without building housing? In other words, take it from the other end. Say, no, I'm sorry, you can't approve that Apple campus. That's going to create 25,000 jobs, and you don't have housing for them. So rather than trying to catch up and say, wait a minute, we're going to let them build anything they want and then try to build enough housing to catch up, why don't we – what would you feel about saying, hey, slow down the development of office space and the new job growth until we have housing, until we've caught up with the housing?
I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to that, but I also think that it's kind of a weird situation where we're saying, let's stunt the economy because we can't bear to build housing. I mean, we should be able to, like, chew gum and walk at the same time. If our economy is growing and we are the largest generator of wealth that I think anybody's ever seen, the Bay Area is an amazing place full of opportunity. We should be able to build housing to meet the fact that our economy is growing.
Very practical question for you, though, Laura. I mean, this is supposed to be streamlining and speeding up the process, but it can extend actually up to 7 years, as I understand it, can't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we need to
In terms of an approval for projects and the like?
Projects can take 15, 20 years. I mean, these projects take decades. I mean, this is the process of getting your approvals right now is completely broken.
So how much streamlining are we really going to get with 35?
It'll be a step forward. I think that it is not going to be as dramatic a step forward as I would like. I would like full by right, of course, but I think that this is a big dramatic step forward. I also find it disingenuous, as a renter, I find it disingenuous that a lot of homeowners who have seen their home values escalate dramatically over the past few years are saying, oh no, building market rate housing won't really help. I mean, you live in market rate housing that is worth millions of dollars, and I'm renting at way an inflated price in the market. And I don't think it's fair to lock people like me out.
And we'll bring more callers on. Oscar, join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call. I understand the need for building more housing, but I think we also need to consider that we also need to build infrastructure. When we look at it, the highway situation is really horrible. It's impassable. Highways are an issue. Schools are crowded already. Electricity supply is an issue. We had brownouts this summer. Water supply was an issue during the drought. So how are we going to handle this? We cannot just you know, bring in jobs first, then build housing, then build infrastructure. Maybe we shall do it the other way around, build infrastructure first, then housing, then bring in the jobs.
Yeah, Oscar, thank you for that. And we're talking about a lot of money here, Tim, when you start suggesting, for example, that maybe instead of a train, we should have more and more affordable housing, truly affordable housing tied to jobs. But then infrastructure does come into the picture, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll go back and say Laura's both end. I think we can have the train and the affordable housing. She's right. The Bay Area is an incredibly wealthy place. There are probably 25 billionaires or more living in the Bay Area. We have so much wealth in this area. We can afford to do a tremendous amount of affordable housing and high-speed rail. Don't get me started on how the rich don't pay taxes, but the reality is that infrastructure is expensive. Building the bus lines, the transit, the water and sewer, everything to serve a huge amount of new housing is very expensive. So as part of any plan like this, we are going to have to figure out how to pay for all that. Market rate housing right now does not pay enough taxes to pay for the infrastructure that's needed to serve it. Right?
About Prop 13?
Yeah, I mean, Prop 13 is one of the reasons, but if you look at the fees that we charge housing developers, we would have to triple, quadruple the fees we charge housing developers, for example, in San Francisco for Muni, to cover the actual cost of providing that service to them. So this is a much larger discussion, Michael, but it is absolutely true that when we talk about building millions of more units of housing, we also have to talk about how we're going to finance billions and billions of dollars worth of the infrastructure that's needed to serve that housing. And the housing itself, because of Prop 13 and because of the crazy way we do taxes and finance in this state, the local government can't raise taxes to pay for that housing. The state government isn't raising taxes to pay for that. So, again, it's a much larger discussion, but the caller's right that serving the infrastructure to serve new housing is a very expensive proposition.
And let me read a comment by Bob, who writes, I live in the Richmond District, and there are miles of 1 to 3-story buildings along Geary Boulevard from Cathedral Hill to Ocean Beach. Build better transit, then tear these useless suburban-style buildings down and put in 4 to 6-story buildings, and you can create a lot of housing in the urban core. And Chelsea writes, can someone define for a comment for me on what the effects SB 35 has on discretionary reviews? And what about the process for neighbors to have a say with the Planning Commission? Maybe we ought to define a little bit what a discretionary review is. But Laura Foote Clark, can we go to you on this?
Yeah, discretionary review I refer to as the I'm still mad hearing. That means that after everything, you know, you've gotten your permits, you think that you're good to go, a neighbor can say, yeah, I understand, but I'm still mad. And so we're going to add another 6 months to a year onto this process where we all, I mean, discretionary review, I'm not a fan.
And the effect of 35 on discretionary reviews? I'm still mad reviews?
Yeah, it'll limit them and probably get rid of them because but only for affordable housing, actually, only for the subsidized affordable housing. So in San Francisco, we're currently meeting our RENA numbers, the regional housing needs for our market rate. And so this will only get rid of the I'm still mad hearing for the 100% affordable, subsidized affordable housing.
And we go to more of your calls. Let me bring Brandon on. Brandon, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hey, you guys. Thanks for your passion on the topic. I think a simple solution would be to make rent control means tested. We got a lot of inventory that's being taken off the market. I personally know quite a few people who are working tech, make tons of money, but get super discount because they've been there a long time. I'd like to know your thoughts off the air. Thank you.
All right. I'll go to you, Tim Redmond.
Means testing rent control has been talked about many, many times. It becomes really, really complicated. Rent control is one of those things that, I mean, the bigger issue, I think, is not means testing rent control. It's, as one of our previous callers said, well, let's tear down all of these smaller buildings out in the Richmond and build bigger buildings. Fine, except those smaller buildings are rent controlled, and the new buildings would not be because the state legislature won't let us put rent controls on new buildings. So if you want to reform rent control, I don't think means testing is the way to do it. I think that the way to do it is for the state legislature to allow cities more flexibility in how they do rent control, which right now is very, very strictly limited by the city. You know, we have rent controls on apartments that are currently occupied. The minute you leave your place, rent control goes off. That, of course, gives landlords an incentive to evict tenants. We can't fix that because the state won't let us. So while Senator Wiener is very happy to go around and the state legislature is very happy to say, let's get rid of discretionary reviews and let's make it easier to build market rate, expensive housing, they're refusing to do anything to make it easier for cities to actually have effective rent control. So I think that's really the issue more than means testing.
And again, Tim Redmond is the editor of 48hills.org, which is an online daily newspaper. And our next caller is Victoria. Morning.
Hi. I just want to say I thought it was a bit interesting that earlier Laura said it takes about 6 years or so for housing to get approved. And I haven't heard much discussion about rolling back or deregulating and making it faster to build affordable housing. I think that's been kind of missing from the conversation. The focus has been a lot on what we're doing to market rate, but I know that some of the bills in the state right now are targeted to affordable housing and streamlining it, so I'd like to hear some thoughts on that.
Yeah, she's right, isn't she, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, SB 35, so the way the regional housing numbers are broken down, it's by income categories, and so actually SB 35 for San Francisco, because we've been meeting our regional housing goals on the market rate and not meeting it for the subsidized affordable stuff, it will only speed up the subsidized affordable stuff in San Francisco, and there are a few other municipalities like that. And it will speed up affordable housing, the subsidized affordable housing in places that, you know, have traditionally blocked it tooth and nail, Marin and all down the South Bay, where it's the subsidized affordable stuff that comes up against the most neighborhood opposition. Additionally, there's other great bills like SB 167, which is going to force municipalities when they have a zoning compliant project to actually approve it. There's, you know, a whole bunch of really great bills that are going to do both more money, SB 2 and 3, for affordable housing. But if you, you know, have all the money in the world, but you're not actually approving the projects, it doesn't really help.
Let me follow that up, that call from Victoria, with a comment from John and get your response, Laura Foote Clark. Mm-hmm. And again, Laura Foote Clark is Executive Director of YIMBY Action, Affordable Housing Advisory and Advocacy Group. John writes, we do have a shortage of housing, but is a short circuit on the approval process the answer? I live in Santa Clara, just off El Camino. We have had to fight tooth and nail, not because we don't want more housing for the average person, but because we don't want our retail replaced by luxury apartments that won't help bring down rental costs for the middle class.
I don't, that idea is anti-housing. I mean, he's saying he doesn't want to replace retail with apartments. So I don't, you know, I mean, at market rate becomes luxury when you have a shortage. I think that that's what it is. Shortages drive up prices. I think there's nothing inherent in a condo that makes it luxury. It's just the price that will bear. It's where it's located and how there's not enough of it that makes it so expensive. I've been in really crappy luxury condos that should not be going for what they're going. I think we all know that prices are inflated right now.
Tim Redmond, here's another listener of ours, Dave, who says using market rates to subsidize below market rate units is simply a redistribution scheme. Adding a price premium to some units to pay for other units makes the market rate units not market rate anymore, and that compounds the problem and it's trying to solve. That's pretty much your position, isn't it?
Definitely.
Well, San Francisco has had a fair amount of success with what we call inclusionary housing, which is basically saying if you are a market rate housing developer and you're going to build 100 units of luxury condos, and by the way, to Laura's point, the reason that condos cost so much and the reason that they're is that's what the return, that's what investors are willing to put money into right now. If the price of condos came down, you wouldn't see the market wanting to build as many of them because the investment capital isn't there. But aside from that, we have had success saying, okay, you want to build 100 units of expensive housing, you have to set aside some amount, 18%, 20% for moderate and lower income people. And we have had some success with that. The issue, though, is that communities, as Fernando said, communities, neighborhoods have been able to go to developers and essentially say, look, you want to put a project in our neighborhood that is going to drive up housing prices for everybody and cause all of these problems. We want you to work with the community to build as much affordable housing as you possibly can. And that has been; those have been often successful negotiations. We have projects in San Francisco that are now 25% or 30% affordable housing because communities have had the right to go to developers and say, look, we're going to oppose this project and make it difficult for you unless you come to the table and do something for the community. And if you take that away, you're going to wind up, I think, getting less affordable housing through this inclusionary process.
Let me go back to something that was said earlier for a moment, Tim, your comment that we ought to tell Apple that they can't come unless there's housing. Most cities would do just about anything to get Apple to create jobs, wouldn't they?
would. And that's what's happening. A lot of cities are saying, yeah, we want the jobs. We also want the tax money that comes in from these big businesses. And we're going to allow this commercial growth very rapidly. And we don't, and then later worry about catching up with the housing. I mean, you know, again, it gets into a much, much larger question that's probably too much for this show, but is it possible that the Bay Area has allowed itself to grow too fast, that the tech job economy has grown too fast, and that we should have slowed it down a little bit? I mean, that's a much larger question for another time, but it is something that's worth, I think, talking about.
Well, it's something that we have talked about sometimes. It feels like till we're blue in the faces, but let me bring another caller on, and this is a caller who's a former San Francisco Planning Commissioner. Shelley, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. This has been, I was on the commission from 02 to 06, and this was an issue we grappled with then and we're still grappling with. We have a lot of gaps in how our process works, and I think we have knee-jerk reactions to a lot of the problems that we have, and we're fixing our problems one thing at a time. We are a very tiny city. We have very little land left to build on, but we have very strict infill policies that are preventing us from doing the things we need to do to perhaps build housing in places where it could be built. But our infill legislation or planning code doesn't allow us to do it. We have very strict neighborhood height limits and, you know, yard distances and so forth that are not allowing us to create density because people don't want density. We have hotels like the Marriott Courtyard on Post Street that went into an old hotel. The building had sat empty for almost 2 years. And because code allows a hotel to be built there, a hotel came in as opposed to, and it's no longer an allowable source in the neighborhood. No hotels are any longer allowed on this block. But here comes a hotel, and that could have been affordable housing. And we're not looking, I think, strategically or with any kind of creativity at how we could be doing housing when we're only 49 square miles mm-hmm. of land. And so we need to look at that. And on the issue, just one last thing on the issue of the inclusionary housing, the big issue for that is building is put up. You get 12 units of affordable housing in it, and 5,000 to 10,000 people apply for it. You're still squeezing out the community that was there, and you're reshaping communities. I think developers need to be held to put money into the community, help those seniors that are there rebuild their houses. They've been there for 50 years. It needs a new roof. It needs mold remediation. Rather than give them an offer they can't refuse to buy their place, let's create programs to help them fix them up. They're not giving seniors loans for that. Let's help them fix them up. Let's retain the community that we have. Let's stabilize first.
Shelley, I appreciate your perspective. It's a long one, though, and I have to go on to other calls, but I thank you for that. I want to go on to a comment here from Justin, who says, both of your guests agree taxes promote hotels and offices, not housing. Why talk about SB 35 instead of reforming Prop 13? I want to get that on the record as well.
I'm in favor. We're actually going to have a panel discussion on Prop 13 coming up.
I think Laura and I will have no disagreement on that one. I think you'll find that we are in complete.
Everybody's in concurrence on that, including your genial host here. Let me get another caller on, though. Mary, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Before the break, Laura spoke about, do we want everyone to live in subsidized housing? I'd just like to point out that the vast majority of homeowners in California who have mortgages live in subsidized housing.
Oh, preach.
They get the biggest subsidy unimaginable, and that's the mortgage interest tax deduction and the property tax deduction. Nationally, the U.S. Treasury misses out on a huge amount of revenue that by itself could pay for every single eligible applicant for Section 8 subsidies three times over. The last time the Oakland Housing Authority opened up their wait list 5 years ago, they got 30,000 applications in 1 week, and they're still going off of that wait list. The people who are living in subsidized housing are the homeowners in these market rate condos and homes. And they don't need the subsidy. Low-income renters are the ones who need subsidies so that they can keep our communities diverse.
Mary, thank you for that.
I couldn't agree more.
No, I agree.
Tim Redmond?
We have, again, this is a larger topic, but there's no question that we subsidize homeowners. We subsidize people who own multiple homes. We subsidize people who have, who buy property and then don't live in it. There's an awful lot of housing in San Francisco that is vacant because people buy it purely as an investment and a tax haven and don't live in it. There's a whole host of other serious problems with the way we handle housing in this state, in this country.
Well, I'm looking at a listener comment here, which we probably ought to conclude with. The listener says, don't let Peninsula City, San Francisco, and Oakland off the hook. They have existing transit that can be enhanced to serve greater population density. Oakland, Palo Alto, Menlo Park, along BART and Caltrain routes. Just drive down there and you'll see the spots that can be developed.
Definitely.
Well, we're going to talk more about housing in coming forum programs, rest assured. Let me thank actually Guy Maserati, who joined us at the top, and Laura Foote Clark. Thank you for joining us. And thanks to Fernando Marti, who was also with us. And thanks to Tim Redmond.
Happy to be here, Michael.
And thanks to you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And another hour coming up. We're going to talk about poetry in the next hour with a local poet and English professor who was New York Times poetry editor and who has a lot to say about why poetry is being taught incorrectly and not appreciated when it should be. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producers Amanda Stupai and Devin Holt. We get online support from Amanda Font. Managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. Executive producer Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.